Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
People. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here this evening. This is really exciting. This is Welcome to Eating Matters. We are a podcast broadcasting on Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. And I just want to give a shout out. This is a live recording from Industry City, and we are so pumped to be here. This is actually my first live podcast situation. So, thank you. Okay. So over the past year, I have been talking a lot about meat, both real animal meat and lab grown and meat alternatives. I've had the pleasure of interviewing a farmer, an animal welfare activist, authors, journalists, scientists, academics, and now I can add to my list a butcher. And pretty much everyone except for Paul Willis, who is said farmer I interviewed a few weeks ago, has said that we as a society need to, well, not eat red meat, or at least reduce our consumption to once per week in order to meet certain sustainability goals, like the ability to produce enough food for the expected 10 million people we will have on this planet by 2050. So it may sound weird that right now I find myself in an actual butcher shop, but I'm here because I think that it is important to get all perspectives of an issue, and who better to talk about issues of eating meat, issues like sustainability, taste preferences, ethics, culture, affordability, all of that that arise when deciding whether or not you should eat meat. Who better to talk to than a butcher? So without further ado, I want to welcome John Ratliff to the show, head honcho of Ends Meat, a whole animal salumeria butcher shop and chef's table. Welcome, John. Yeah. That's right off your website.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm going to have to pay whoever did that double for sure. Hi, thanks for having me.
So, salumeria, did I say that correctly?
Absolutely.
Yes. So, by the way, also I said you're the head honcho. That is officially, that's what's on your website. I've never interviewed a head honcho before.
Why the hell I wrote head honcho on the website? I don't know.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It means I couldn't figure out a name for myself or a title. I don't know what I am. It happens all the time where it's like, am I a president? Am I an owner? Am I the head butcher? Am I the head chef? Am I a salumieri or a charcutier? I have no idea. I'm just running a small business.
Charcuterie?
Charcuterie?
Oui, oui.
But yeah, I think I think I was kind of making light of the fact that in order to do this whole animal thing successfully, you have to wear a lot of hats. And I have no idea what the name of that hat is.
It's a head honcho. There you go.
It's like a big one. It's like a big sombrero, but with feathers.
I didn't see the feathers coming from the chicken.
Fucking feathers. But yeah, there's feathers in there, for okay. Sure.
All right, cool. Well, now that I got I got it down. All right, so this is not your normal shop, I would say. You've got a lot going on here.
What do you mean normal?
You guys are very, what is the word I'm looking for? You got a lot, I forget the word. It starts with a C.
Multifaceted.
Yeah, sure, multifaceted. I was going to say, there are a lot of different facets to your business. It's not just a butcher shop. It's a chef's table also, apparently, that you felt like that was news to you.
Well, I don't know. I just never heard it called a chef's table before. That's so Michelin star terminology.
I think it seems accurate. I think it.
People sit down at our butcher block and eat 8 courses.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call that. Is that
a chef's table?
Yeah.
Can we call it a butcher's table?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Butcher's table. That's so much better. All right. So, I would say, can you just kind of give us the spiel behind like an overview of all of the different services that you have? Like you have a meat kind of share too, right? That I don't think I mentioned.
Yeah, we do. Let me see. There is what don't we do? That might be easier to. We just built a bakery in the basement.
You did not.
I swear.
Really?
It's right below you.
Well, I don't have any treats from the bakery in front of me, so I. Oh, for the bread. The bread. Oh, okay. All right. You're getting me a piece of bread. This is amazing. Oh, I'm going to give you the mic and I'm going to eat that.
Okay. I'll take the mic.
You can tell us more about.
This is where I get a takeover now.
Yeah.
All right. Let me lean back here. This is going to take a while. So in like the overall aspect of whole animal, and in relation to the business and its location, the demographic that we see out here, we've kind of transferred and transitioned and moved into and moved away from and grown out of necessity and pulled back from out of necessity into this thing that we get a response out of. So we are, first and foremost, we are a butcher shop, Salumeria. Butcher shop, you know, we bring in whole animals, we cut them down, we serve fresh cuts, and we make, you know, oh, like 100 different types of protein products, right? Salumeria, that is the focus on salted cured meats. That they're one of the big reasons why I got into it. They have the main focus on that is fermentation. And I totally geeked out on that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later.
But so we do, I like to call them fermented, like cured fermented dried meats. And then what else do? We're a sandwich shop, but we're a little more than a sandwich shop. We kind of do this thing where you, like we have sandwiches and then we change our menu every day. We only bring in so much, so when you bring in a whole pig, you only get 4 pork shanks. That's like 8 orders of one thing. So that means one day you can run 8 orders of pork shanks. So we constantly change specials to help utilize cuts that aren't moving in a cured fermented fashion or raw through the case. And so that's the kind of like prepared food sandwich deli part. And then we do a lot of podcasts. This will be the 5th one we've done this week.
Really?
We got one right after you. we work with some restaurants. Mm-hmm. We work with I've had some very long-standing relationships that we still rely on as a big part of our business.
So does that mean you are like the wholesaler kind of for the restaurants? Like they source their meat through you and you source it directly from the farm?
Well, I mean, obviously we're going directly to the farm. But a lot of it is more specialized products. Very, very like, yeah. We're not sending over like a bunch of mass quantities of meats. It's the products we specialize in that they can't find other places. What else do we do? We do our CSA, which is meat share. People commit to a season, a 12-week cycle, pay in advance, and either every week or every other week, we supply them with what should be their either weekly consumption or 2-weekly consumption, mm-hmm. Bi-weekly consumption. Sometimes I wonder if bi-weekly means twice a week or once every 2 weeks?
I think it can mean both. I think semi is like semi-weekly is all right, whatever. So yeah.
Two-way weekly?
I think so. Yeah.
Can I say bi-weekly?
Yeah, bi-weekly is yes.
Twice a month.
Yes, that's correct.
Except for those 52 weeks in the year. I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm really bad at math.
It's okay. You're doing great. So we have our CSA. We do a lot of catering. We do off-site events. A lot of those focus on whole animal roasts. So we'll do a lot of weddings, roast whole pigs, feed a lot of people. You know, I wear overalls. It's kind of fun.
Do you wear the hat?
I have to wear a smaller version of it. At that point in time, it's more like a fedora. It's like it's shrunken down. So we do catering. We have the bakery downstairs. That's a new thing, baking all our bread in-house, partnered with a lady who has a company called Bread and Roses, and just needed a place to get her company started. So we set up a bakery in the basement. She's been producing beautiful bread for us. We're using it at our two locations. We just opened our second location in the Lower East Side.
Congratulations on that. That's super, super exciting. I think you should come closer. Come closer. Carefully. There you go. It's a little too close. No, just kidding. I'm kidding. It's great. Okay, so I want to talk about your second location. You just put a lot out there. You're clearly a very, very busy man. I want to hear from you why you decided to open a butcher. Did you start with the actual... It seems like you probably started with the actual butcher shop, right? And then built from there. So how did you kind of get your start in this industry? And why?
Wait, I don't think we got through all the aspects of my hat yet. We didn't get to the feather part.
We'll come back to it.
We'll come back. We'll loop it around.
Back, yeah.
All right. What was the question again? How did I get my start?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. This is going to be a 3-hour podcast. Right. I didn't know if I could say that. Like, can you throw shout outs?
I have as many followers as he does.
No way.
Yeah, totally true.
Wow, this is a big deal. I'm about to get really nervous. Mm-hmm. Am I blushing yet?
No.
Okay, good.
A little bit.
Started cooking young, culinary background, moved around the country.
Did you go to culinary school?
I did. I grew up in New Mexico and then went to culinary school in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like one of those quick shots out of high school. Hit the road real quick and Portland, Oregon for a little while. Mainly that was so I could smoke weed and snowboard.
Yeah.
But kind of really got into some good restaurants and started cooking aggressively and kind of stopped snowboarding and stopped smoking weed and just started cooking. I got really serious about it. I moved to Chicago. I got hired at a restaurant called Moto. This was in like 2006. And worked there for a little over a year. And then spent some time trailing at a restaurant called Alinea. Trailed there for a long time and worked at a couple other really good, they're all like Michelin-starred restaurants, a place called North Pond, a place called Boca.
Alinea seems far afield of what you do now. What kind of stuff did you learn there that you apply to your work here every day?
I don't know, how to keep my apron clean, how to sweep a floor.
Good, okay.
No, I don't know, I just like so when I was working at Moto, I would work, I'd have like one day off. And I'd spend that one day at Alinea.
Slacker.
Slacker.
One day.
Exactly. Dude, when you're 21, if you can't work 7 days a week, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, I
don't know. I'm making a terrible joke. Nobody should work 7 days a week. It's fucking maniacal. What I do now is a very far cry from what I was doing then and The reason why it's such a far cry is because I didn't really, it took me a little bit to realize what it was, and that wasn't who I was. It wasn't what I cared about. It was like the science was there, the technique, the concept was amazing, but nothing was about sourcing. Nothing was about a bigger picture. And don't get me wrong, there's tons of restaurants sourcing amazingly. I just wanted to be a little closer to it. And then I moved to New York, and I was, there was a restaurant called the Voce that, gave me a job when I first moved here. And that was, like at the end of 2008, early 2009.
Was that in,
Columbus
Circle?
No, it was their first location on 26 in Madison. And I got hired there right when Andrew Carmelini left and Missy Robbins took over the kitchen. And I swear she just hired me because she had just moved from Chicago also. And she's like, Chicago guys. Yeah, I got somebody on my team. And I worked there for a little bit. I was her sous chef for a little over a year. Almost said sous chef. I was better than a sous chef.
Yeah.
I was way better than a sous chef. And kind of a couple of things happened. I was working, you know, long weeks, and it was, you know, 2010 and not really making much money, wasn't really doing much for me outside of work, and just kind of made a decision. I was just like, look, if I'm going to work this hard, I'd like it to be for myself. And at the same time, I just had this like strong interest in learning how to make salami. I just worked in a handful of restaurants very seriously, and nobody was like, everybody's buying it. Nobody's making it. Nobody has an in-house salumi program. Now tons of places do, but at that point in time, there were very few places, and I just was so enthralled by this thing that I was like, what is fermented meat? Like, that sounds like we're going to kill people.
Yeah.
And
So let's do it.
Yeah. So why not buy 5 fridges and line the wall of your apartment in Bushwick and start?
Is that what you did? Is that how this started?
Well, it started with 1 fridge.
Okay.
It didn't like I wasn't just like, all right, line up the fridges. We're going in. It was a slow progress, progression, progressiveness.
Yeah.
Biweekly progressiveness.
Semi-weekly.
What I was doing was I was the chef de cuisine there, Hillary Sterling, who's amazing. She has a restaurant called Vix, which is phenomenal. If you shouldn't go, then please go. If you should go, then double go. And she had spent some time in another restaurant making salami. She showed me a couple of batches of salami, and I was just like absolutely enthralled. And so I'd work my like whatever 14, 16-hour shift, and then I would make salami in the basement. And I actually didn't tell Missy Robbins this until a couple of years ago, because there was like no way she was going to be okay with me making salami in her basement.
Didn't want to break that news.
A couple years.
You open Lilia up and get a lot of praise for that. Then we'll come back to this conversation.
No, I definitely waited till the James Beard Award, where I was like, "Yeah, dude, you're too far past to even worry about that shit." So I would make salami in the basement, and I'd put it in my backpack, and I'd ride my bike home and let it ferment, and then put it in a fridge and let it age for 4 months, and really, really cross my fingers and hope it turned out. 9 times out of 10, it did not. But the one time it did was amazing. And I took it to every single bar I went to and gave it out to all my friends. And lo and behold, some chefs wanted to start buying it from me, which you can't talk about. at all. That's not even like not even
a thing.
So you started, you made it in a basement, and then you took it home in your backpack to put it in a fridge, and then a few months later, you were like, let's see if this works out. And mostly it didn't, but sometimes you didn't, it did, and then you're like, who wants to buy this?
I wasn't as much trolling for people. It was like, I'd show up to a bar with a salami in my pocket and a knife and be like, hey, bud. Happy to see. It was a little more curated than that. All right, I have some tact. Like, I don't, no, it was. It took a long time for me to pull down anything that I felt somewhat decent about that I would share with the world. A lot of things went out in trash bags, unfortunately. But what I was able to start doing is figuring out what it was to properly pH meat, and then what temperatures, humidities, molds, and well, not molds, but bacteria that I wanted to work with to make something that was unique and worked in the environment that I had, which was a one-bedroom apartment in Bushwick. Which they don't make a lot of those bacterias, you know? They're not, like, targeting those. They're like, all right, this one's for a USDA facility. This one's for a one-bedroom apartment, which is so important, the type of bacteria that goes into an inoculated salumi. They're all inoculated to a certain degree, but there is the ability to utilize more natural inoculant, which is like taking it from an older batch. I was not confident enough in those days to do that, nor am I now. That's a tricky game. But okay, back on track. Fermenting, curing meats in my apartment. Started with one fridge, two fridge, three fridge, blah, 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 blah. Sounds like a child's home. One, two fridge, two, three, four fridge. And then after about a year of doing that, I decided it was time to either do it or don't do it. I'd left Avoce at that time. I was kind of helping a restaurant start up in Greenpoint called Callier. And working in the basement there, the owners, there was a couple of owners, one of them old in building, and the other one, who is a good friend of mine, owns a bunch of other places. They were like, you know what, bring whole animals in here. Like, we are okay with it. And that lasted for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And then one day they're just like, you got to get out of here. This can't work. And there just happened to be a pig on the table that day. So I got lucky enough to know a guy that had a loft space down the street. And he was just using it for, like, he was the guy who built out the restaurant. So he'd go around to auctions and pull a bunch of equipment and cool old knickknacks and then store them in a loft and then build out a restaurant. And he let me rent that space from him. So it was a 1,400-square-foot space on the third floor of a building that absolutely 100% is not kosher for food production.
Not literally, but in any
form of the word.
So it sounds like a long journey, and now you're at this beautiful space in Industry City. How many years did it take for me to get to your apartment to this incredible location that you are at now?
I thought you said you had 3 hours on this podcast, dude. I'm leaning into this. Okay, so I did that. Here's the deal. I did that for a little bit. The best part about that was, since it wasn't for food production, I had to hide the fact that I turned a loft space into a butcher shop. And I rented the front side of it out to a guy who upholstered couches. And the butcher shop was behind it. And I did that for 4 years. And I only...
In Greenpoint? Where was this?
67 West Street.
Okay, 67 West Street.
No. Yes.
Okay. That's like me when people are like, "Oh yeah, I'm from Kansas." I'm like, "Where in Kansas?" I don't know anything.
Do you know my friend Ryan?
Anyway, so
you were like a front.
I was a total front, yeah. And I was just working. Like, I had a legit LLC. I started Innsmead LLC in 2010, and I was making legal transactions. Mm-hmm. However, not like legally producing.
Yeah.
But after 4 years, I had a little bit of a financial track record. And that's when I came out here. And is my math correct? I came out here in 2015. Mm-hmm. 2015? I think I signed the lease in 2014. I don't know. These leases take so long. And yeah, so the beginning of it over there was working with farms, right? So the farms I work with now, I started the business working with.
Okay. And I want to talk about some of those farms. So you say on the website, well, and just so I want to kind of say, like, congratulations on making it here. It's been, like, sounds like a total journey to make it to Industry City. So, and it's worth it, I would say. I'm going to speak for you and say totally worth it.
Yeah, a lot of management.
Worth it anyway. All right, so you on the website say, big part of your value proposition is that you work with responsibly raised animals. So I would like to know a little bit more about what responsibly raised means to you and what factors you take in consideration when deciding to work with a farm. When deciding to work with a farmer, particular farmer.
Can you do me a favor?
Depends on what the favor is.
Will you describe what value proposition means to you?
What differentiates you from other butchers, and what makes you like, what is it that you're giving to the customer that's like totally unique and differentiates you from other competitors?
Cool, because I was about to give you a totally different description.
Like the term responsibly raised, no official definition, right? So in terms of like legally federal level, so what does that mean? It can be totally whatever you want it to be.
Well, what does organic mean?
There is an official standard definition of that. That's like pretty very specific and long, and some would say needs to be updated. But like, there is. I mean, these are like sustainably raised, environmentally responsible. These are marketing terms, and a lot of people use them for. Wait, why are you holding the microphone? I am the one doing the interview here. I'm keeping the mic raised. It's my microphone. So I think that these are terms that a lot of brands and companies, they're very popular right now. There's a lot of greenwashing that goes on, right? And so you can say like, we're a butcher shop and we only work with responsibly raised, you know, we only responsibly source our animals, whatever. But that doesn't, what does that mean, right? It can be defined in a lot of different ways.
So one thing you'll notice on all of our walls, we have a ton of marketing language all over the place.
That's not true.
We just beat it into people's head. No, I mean, at the end of the day, for me, something that's more important than a lot of the marketing language and terminology is the reality that we support farms directly, and we support farms that I think I personally agree with their practices and their methods, and I personally agree with who they are as people, and I built a business around supporting them.
So what are some of those practices? By the way, I know you have, is Cascoon one of your farmers? And they are, I have to say, that they're the only place I get my chicken from, actually. So I hit your website and saw that, and as a consumer who knows a little bit more in this space, I was like, amazing. They know what they're doing. But for other people who may not be as familiar with your suppliers or, you know, with your shop in general, can you just kind of break down a little bit what, like, you say that you feel good about their practices? So maybe an example of how they treat whatever animal they raise, like a cat or your beef farmer, let's say.
The beef farmer is kind of, he's pretty special, I think. I mean, outside of the fact that He's a fifth generation bee farm on 400 acres, like a little close to Vermont, outside of Troy. They used to do dairy. It used to be a dairy farm, and they couldn't make it as a dairy farm, and they transitioned into beef. But I mean,
when I'm just curious, when, because dairy farmers have been in a bad way recently, the past few years specifically.
No, like 15 years ago. But I think not everything up there is in a bad way. It's just like to sustain that much acreage and to sustain not being able to feed grain and increase your animal's weight faster. You really have to maintain your land. You really have to work hard at it. And they're like driving school buses and delivering mail for USPS so that they can pay their rent, or so they can pay their taxes, so they can pay for their farm. And to me, that's sad. Like 400 acres, beautiful, pristine pasture land. I think a really important term or phrase that doesn't get utilized often enough in describing sustainable agriculture is regenerative agriculture. And utilizing your soil as the true quality standpoint of how your farm's doing, and rotating and treating your animals in a way that benefits your land, and being good enough to make sure that benefits the animals in the same way. That's a lot of work.
Do you visit the farms before you agree to work with a particular supplier, like personally?
I've only worked with like 3 suppliers since I've started this business, so.
Yes. So that's yes, frequently, which was another one of my questions. Yeah, it seems like you have a limited number of suppliers, so I'm curious about why you made that decision.
Well, I mean, I'm in it to support these farms. If they have the capacity to raise more animals, then my goal is to have the capacity to purchase those animals from them. If I go elsewhere or purchase animal, you know, if I purchase animals anywhere else, then I am not supporting the farm to my fullest. And that's what it is for me.
About the relationship.
Yeah, it's about really supporting a farm.
Okay. Wow. Very, very cool. It's funny because I think that it seems like when farmers agree to, you can't actually walk away from the interview because then I have to, okay, I'll keep talking. It seems like that's really important. You know, I think that there are, for a farmer to have a trust in a supplier or in like a vendor, right? A retailer. I think that trust is, hard to forge too. So it seems like you did it. Congratulations.
So when I was working in Greenpoint, the whole point of doing Greenpoint was so that I could sustainably grow to this point, to opening my own brick and mortar. And they knew that goal and they were on board for that goal. When I first opened here, I don't have any investors or any partners. This is all on loans, and I was able to work with farms in the regard that they loaned me the animals until I could pay them back.
Wow. That's a lot of trust that they are putting in you. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's beyond amazing. I mean, they are true business partners in Inns Meet. I think at that point in time, we are probably 90% fermented cured product, which can have an average turnaround time of 4 to 6 months. That's a lot of cash sitting around in a room drying out. And I wasn't able to really produce a product for 4 months. So what they did was they didn't send me an invoice for 6 months. I was getting beef every week, pigs every week, and I was able to pay them back without interest over the next year, spread out. So a little, pretty like aggressive farm bankish loan.
Farmers don't usually have a whole lot of money to loan out themselves.
But they do have these assets that if I wasn't buying them, they weren't going to be, they weren't going anywhere anyway. And let's be honest, like a farm to turn around an animal, that's going to take 2.5 years. Yeah. Like in the grass-fed world, when they're getting these animals close to 30 months, and unfortunately, some of them go over 30 months, which is something else we can talk about at another time, which sucks. But it's great for the meat. It's bad for the spine. We'll talk about that.
Okay, so I want to take a really quick break and want to give a big thanks to our sponsors here at Industry City and just let everybody know that Industry City is New York's hub for the innovation economy, a diverse mix of over 500 businesses called Industry City Home, collaborating across the 16-building campus, merging today's creative sectors like tech, content creation, and design with craft making and traditional manufacturing and butchering. The Industry City food scene is a rich yet approachable international experience for every palate. With 5 acres of outdoor space, more than 50 experiential food vendors and retailers, plus unrivaled tenant amenities, Industry City is a bustling hub where 8,000 people come to work daily and thousands stop by for a visit. Wow, 8,000 people. Well done, Industry City. That's impressive. And it's just the coolest space in Brooklyn. So, okay. I feel like I have 10,000 more questions for you. You know what I kind of want to do? I just want to ask you some personal questions first because we haven't quite gotten personal yet. And then I want to come back and talk about what whole animal butchering means to you. I want to talk a little about pricing issues. And I want to talk to you. There's probably like one other question that I have in there, but we'll find it. All right, here's the thing that I really want to know. 100% grass-fed or grass-fed grain-finished?
You know what I really like is...
this question?
Grain-fed, grass-finished. I find that hilarious.
Like, I think that's like a CAFO, but okay.
Absolutely.
People like that, you know, like a fancy CAFO.
Oh, people, so like, I don't know. Anyways, there we go. Are you asking or are you questioning? Because I feel like you're questioning.
No, I'm asking. I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours.
100% grass fed. Mm-hmm. Never fed grain. You don't like it.
I'm a grass grain. I like a grain finished piece of steak. Is that terrible? I don't actually feel bad about it. I don't feel bad about it. Don't make me feel bad about it. No, I don't feel bad about it. What is your favorite? What?
Like 99% of people eat fully grain-fed beef. At least the beef you're eating and liking eats a little grass.
They eat all grass and just a little bit of grain at the end. And I know the farmer. Not personally, but I know where it comes from. Okay, anyway. Here's another question. Favorite cut of beef? Is this annoying? These like boring questions. I don't care. I really want to know.
We're going to revert back to the farm you buy your beef from.
This that farm, stay on farm.
Cool. Favorite cut of beef is never, ever the same. I don't have a favorite cut of beef. And that's not like me being like, ooh, I don't have a favorite dish on a menu or whatever. One of the things I love about grass-fed, the grass-fed world, is the same thing that everybody hates about it. It's very inconsistent. But I find it so refreshing when you're, it's not monotonous. Everything gets monotonous. Every job gets repetitive, right? But when you're butchering an animal that's a little different every week, protein structure, fat structure, densities, it's fun. And sometimes the cut that you liked last week isn't as great on the next animal. And there's like, I don't have one favorite. I will say people definitely need to realize how much of certain cuts come from an animal. Like if you bring in a 900 pound beef and you get a pound and a half of hanger steak, that shit should go for like $26 a pound, dude. I know, it should. So that's the thing. It's like all those older, like the cuts that got really popular, kind of like late 90s, mid 2000s, that used to be considered just butcher's cuts, for those to be popular, a facility or an abattoir or whatever, they have to be processing hundreds of animals a day to make that a thing. So it's like, it's a little more special when it's coming from a small butcher shop that does two animals a week. You know, when you get 3 pounds of hanger steak a week, you can't afford for that to be your favorite cut. You know what my favorite cut this week is? Top round. Delish.
Send only you. I'm like, hanger steak's my favorite, but you know, once it's gone, it's gone. Okay, let's good transition into whole animal butchering. What does that mean? Like, really the whole animal? Like, I feel like, what aren't you using? You're miming the butchery technique, and from, I don't know, I have no experience, but I think it looks good. I thought that's what it was, yeah.
It's too bad this is not video. What does it mean? What are you using?
All right, so there's things you legally can't get from a USDA facility. Let's talk about that right now. We work with a facility called Eagle Bridge in Eagle Bridge, New York. They started as a small family farm that wanted to process their own animals. They were able to turn that into a USDA facility so they can process animals for the farms surrounding them. What if I do it around my nose? That'll be my vantage point. I'll be around my nose. Is that better?
Yeah.
I'm afraid of it. What's on there? Where's this thing been? I don't know where this thing has been. Great. Okay. You're definitely going to have to sanitize it after this. Eagle Bridge. Okay, so, like a small USDA facility that works with farms in its surrounding area. And USDA isn't allowing animals over 30 months to keep their spine because of, just real quick, mad cow disease lives in the cerebral cortex, so they say. It can't, it's a prion that could be there at that age, either if the back row of teeth are coming in or if it's above 30 months. They pull the spine. So you can't control that. If an animal is bolted in the head, to stun it, not to kill it, to stun it, they will not let you keep the head. You do not get the head. They'll pull the tongue out, but they won't let you keep the head.
To bolt it, to stun it before it goes to slaughter.
So humanely, you wanna stun an animal before you slit its throat. When you slit its throat, it needs to be hanging upside down. It's very stressful to hang a 1,300-pound beef upside down while it's alive. Or a 400-pound pig.
Yeah.
You know? So what they do is they stun it. If the stun doesn't work, then they have to shoot it. And then they hang it upside down, slit its throat, let it bleed out. And pigs, they electric shock right on the temples. But since the bolt goes through the hide, which has not been sanitized, into the skull, they deem the skull as unsanitized, or insanitary, or insane. Fucking, I don't know. I don't work for the USDA. So you don't get the head for sure. And then the hide gets pulled from the animal. That generally goes to tanneries. The hooves are pretty much useless to a certain degree. One, they're hard to fully remove all the particulate and all the hair from to pass a USDA inspection so they can go out. It's different in every state, and honestly, every facility is different. They're all about relationships with this inspector. Once the hide comes off and the viscera comes out of the animal, what we receive are the heart, the liver, the kidneys. We'll get the caul fat. We'll get the leaf lard. We get the thymus gland. And I don't think I'm missing anything. We don't get the lungs, which fucking pisses me off. Sorry. We get the tongue. They'll pull the tongue out. But we don't get the cheeks. You know what's crazy? Off of one, 900-pound beef, you get a half pound of beef cheeks. What do you do with a half pound of beef cheeks?
You tell me.
You put it in the freezer until you get 3 pounds of beef cheeks, and then you make ragu out of it. Yeah. So those are the things we don't get. The things we don't get are because of restrictions based that are implemented by the USDA in the specific state, in the specific facility.
Do you work with have you ever killed the animals yourself as part of the slaughtering process?
No, I have not.
Is that something you want to experience in any way? I mean, no one's like, yeah, I want to kill an animal today, but like, would it be kind of consistent with like, we use the whole part of the animal? I don't even know how to describe that on air. never mind. So yeah, would you think that it is like consistent with like the ethos of knowing every single part of the process? And I really don't think it smells that bad. And I think you're dodging the question. That's what I think is happening. I think that you're dodging the question. Yeah. Has anyone ever been like, well, you haven't killed the animal yourself, so you don't have like, I don't know, full credibility. Not credibility. Can you help me out with this question here, please?
I am. Credibility, what are we talking about?
Like killing the animal yourself.
Would you?
I absolutely would. I'm not going to ask some USDA facility to let me go in there and kill my own animal. One, they wouldn't let me do it because you have to be an insured employee of the facility. And two, I let the professionals do it. They know what they're doing. Do I want to kill the animal? I don't know. I'm not indifferent to it. I think if I was to slaughter an animal, it would be on a farm, and it would be like kind of gunshot to the head scenario, slaughtered on the farm. But that would never be able to walk into my shop. I could never sell that to another person.
Because it wasn't in a USDA approved facility. But there are farms where you can process on the farm, like, it doesn't Cascoon process all of its chickens on its farm?
Yeah, they have a USDA facility.
So I'm just saying, you could go to Cascoon.
They do chickens, bro.
Whatever, same thing. Have you ever killed a chicken?
Of course I've killed a fucking chicken. That's like, I feel like everybody's grandma's killed a chicken. Like, that's not really...
It's a low bar? I haven't, but okay. All right, so... So do these farmers, the beef farmer, your pork farmer, they have relationships. They like go to one slaughterhouse and they know they have that relationship. So there's kind of like full transparency along the supply chain.
Well, there's 100% full transparency. Whether or not emotions come into play, that's another thing. I think my beef 100% of the time gets processed at the same facility. The pigs kind of depends on who's on the kill floor at specific facilities. One facility that'll process the pigs from the farm we work with will not do pigs that are over 350 pounds, which poses a problem for us. I kind of made a specific decision. Is that a good way to specify a decision? Specific decision, right? I wanted larger pigs. I wanted older pigs that are more mature. Couple of reasons. The main reason being the protein structure is far more developed. So in Europe, pigs are going to be a lot bigger than they are in the States because they appreciate salumi and charcuterie and they understand the importance of protein development when you do even just a brined cooked product. So these animals are 350 to 400 pounds minimum that are going to slaughter. So these, because they're so big, they had to go to a different facility. But this other facility, they're hourly workers. It is what it is. Sometimes they make mistakes and sometimes they suck and I get really mad. Because it's a bummer when you buy a whole animal and pay somebody to kill it and split it in half and send you all the organs and they don't do a good job at it, which is a real thing.
So then what happens?
I have a 30-minute conversation with the guy that owns the facility and hope it doesn't happen for a month.
Okay. So can I ask you a question?
Oh,
that I was, before this interview, I was preparing and I looked up and sometimes I like to ask people what I should ask. You know, I'm talking to this person. What would you want to hear them talk to? And I asked this to my friend. And she goes, yes, how does he sleep at night? And then I realized she's a vegan. So I don't know. Do you have any response? I think I was asking the wrong person, but, I'd forgotten that, but I don't know. What would you say?
Like a fucking baby.
All right. That makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, work a 14-hour day and tell me how you sleep. I sleep great.
Okay, so that is it. That I was joking. Obviously, I mean her question was real, but probably. Do you
every day on Instagram? By the way,
on Instagram, yeah. But there is something to be said for the fact that it is universally known and to be true that. Whenever you talk to like a scientist, anyone who's thinks about climate change, anyone who that keeps them up at night, the number one thing that the advice for consumers that scientists, academics, everybody says is eat less meat, right? I mean, because cows are a major emitter of greenhouse gases. And I'm just wondering how you kind of that squares with the fact that, I mean, for your living, you process and support, you process beef and support farmers who raise beef. So I'm wondering your perspective on where you kind of fall, knowing that those two things are true.
I don't promote meat consumption. I hate that I use this word as often as I do. Can you give me a better word to replace it? I try to promote responsible consumption. Eat less meat, but eat better quality meat. I don't think 200 head of cattle on 400 acres that's rotated properly adds to greenhouse emissions. I don't. I'm sorry. I don't. You know what I do think adds to greenhouse emissions? I think 1,000 head of cattle on 5 acres of land stuffed with corn and soy and hormones and antibiotics. Yeah. That does nothing for the soil. That doesn't generate grass or plants that are going to process carbon. It does absolutely nothing but produce emissions. And I am a strong believer in supporting grass-fed 100% of the way. And this is like my whole thing about grass-fed versus grass-fed grain finish. Like, I don't care about grain. Like, I would love us to get away from corn and soy. Honestly, like, why do we need 1 million sweeteners? Like, why is our farm bill dedicated towards subsidizing corn, soy, and wheat? Why don't we subsidize the thing that's actually causing carbon emissions? Like, let's donate some land to some grass-fed beef farmers. Help subsidize them.
Obviously, you've missed my past few episodes on crop subsidy on the crop insurance program, but you should definitely catch up on them, and I totally agree. Okay, so thank you for your response to that. And as a follow-up, and not to put you in the hot seat, which is such a lame term. So good. So you shouldn't break your chair. Good food, so people should eat meat, or people should, yeah, you're like, people should eat meat, not too much. People should eat better meat. Better meat takes longer to produce, is produced with more care. It costs more. How have you gotten the kind of question or feedback from people that it's like, well, your food's too, your meat's too expensive, your food's too expensive. And what do you say if you've, I'm sure you've gotten that question. I feel like people question the price of food all the time, no matter what it is. So what do you say in response?
I don't know. I'm like a really pompous hipster butcher. So people just see that when they walk in the door and they're like, I ain't even going to talk to this dude. I mean, it kind of goes back to what I was like, I was pointing out the fact that, like, we do not use all the marketing terminology. We do not beat people over the head with all the trendy words that people want to hear to feel good about what they want to buy. We do instigate a conversation. And we want people to have a conversation with us because we don't think people need to hear everything. People need to hear what they want to hear, but more importantly, they're consumers. They're coming in to buy. They're not coming in to, like, join a new religion. You know, like, some people can afford to buy the meat that we sell because they can afford it and they feel good about that. Some people can't afford it, but they still buy it because they believe in what we do and they want to eat protein that makes them feel better. And I don't want to lump anybody into the same category. So we get it all the time. Our meat's too expensive. Or why does this cost this? Or why does this cost this? And it's hard for it not to be insulting, to be honest with you. Because it's like, what people don't see is the amount of time and effort that goes on behind the scenes. Not just on the farms. I mean, to be able to raise 100% grass-fed animal takes 2.5 years. That's a long time, you know? And they don't know that. If they want to know, we'll tell them about it.
Okay, have to leave it there for today. Big thanks to Industry City for hosting us. Eating Matters is produced with help from Jessica Duncan and Julia Devon. Big thanks to our show engineer as well, Matt Patterson, for this episode. Show music is by Tim Archer. You can find all episodes of Eating Matters on Heritage Radio Network's website or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.